You know what they say, they, regarding the changing of millennia, which in either event is 2001, it's not 2000, but regarding that issue, the Jews have been there a number of times already. We're already in the seventh millennium, and I've been there, done that, as they say. But there's a very, very interesting thought from the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon writes that it says in Tehillim, it says in Psalms, Ki elef shanim be'einecha kayom etmo, that 1,000 years is as a day in God's eyes. So the Vilna Gaon draws a comparison that each millennium in Jewish history corresponds to a day of creation. So the year 1 to 1,000, the events, if you'd match them up, again, I haven't been able to read the entire correlation, it's supposed to correlate to what God created on Sunday. So consequently, when we're in 5,760, we are in the tail end, we are in the latter third of the sixth millennium. So this corresponds to Erev Shabbat, late in the afternoon. Because Mashiach, the Messianic era, is described as Yom Shekulo Shabbat, the eternal Shabbat, which begins no later than the year 6000. But of course, one can begin Shabbat early. So consequently, this is early enough, or late enough on Friday afternoon, based on that chronology, that this can indeed be considered to be the footsteps of the Mashiach. And the Vilna Gaon indeed writes that during the second half of the sixth millennium, it is time to particularly get ready for the coming of the Mashiach. So, well, yeah, well, okay, I understand, but
and I think Jews did not use the decimal system in the early days
anyway. Why not?
Well, no, as far as I understood, we did, but you know, I obviously there are alternative ways of measuring time. That's true. We measure it many different ways. Oh, okay. Very good. Okay, so again, we're continuing with the Kuzari guest. Oh yeah, I do have to make one announcement. Because my law school schedule has changed starting next week, I am not available Wednesday for the balance of the semester. I can make up those classes on Thursday. So, just have to ask yourself, in other words, same time.
Starting when?
Starting next week. In other words, this is the last Wednesday I'm available for the balance of this course.
We don't have
Because
that's fine. But the point is,
but the point is that
however longer this course goes, unless it goes into June. Okay, so for the last three sessions, we'll have to do it another day. I won't be able to be here on Wednesday. Of this course, and of this course.
The 19th, the 26th.
The 3 in February,
so
you want to
take
the 2nd, the 16th.
Well, I'm told that next week there's no class either. Yeah, so next week there is no class anyway, okay? That's nothing to do with what I'm announcing. We have class the 19th. No,
I'm going to
right. So everything would have to be one day off. In other words, goes on into March. Okay, but it goes on forever. I guess there's all the breaks. Okay, but the point is, you know, in the regular academic world, we have some new semesters that have been, you know, this course is a continuing semester, but the semester changes. So every single remaining date should be moved by one to a Thursday.
So
Thursday, January 20th. Same time, yeah. Oh, okay. All right, so that'll be a little, okay, so that'll be a little complicated. So in effect, we can eliminate the skip days. Okay, I'll check it. All I'm saying is that it would have to be Thursday. I mean, you know, we'll work it out. If not this room, some other room or something. But
next week
there's no class anyway. We'll see about the other omissions. Maybe we'll work something out. But at least for next week, there will not be a class. That's the only day I have for the balance of the semester here, yeah, balance of the course. Okay, we're continuing with. Well, again, I apologize, but as I say, the schedule changes beyond my control. Okay, we are still doing our study of the Kuzari. and we're moving into the middle of the third essay. And here he makes some very important points, again, not so much for their philosophical import, but because of their theological and even practical importance. And he has a very vivid portrayal of how a true servant of God gets a lot of joy in the world and enjoys even physical pleasures and does not take an ascetic stance, right? This is already, you know, this is an idea that has already entered popular consciousness to such a degree that it doesn't even sound particularly novel. And nevertheless, the Khuzri is one of the early people who articulated in a very systematic way that religious experience does not require, nor does it entail, separation and rejection of the physical world, but rather one embraces the physical world with a sense of joy and appreciation, and one elevates it. One would call this a statement of anti-asceticism, a statement in which pleasure itself can be sanctified when it's undertaken with gratitude and a spiritual dimension of what God has given us. The classic Talmudic text that supports this idea is the statement in the Talmud that the Nazir, the person who takes a vow not to drink wine, must bring a sacrifice at the conclusion of his Nazirut. And the reason that is given, according to one opinion, is because becoming a Nazirite, becoming a Nazir, itself was a sinful action because he is depriving himself of the pleasures of wine. God has given us wine to enjoy in moderation. He who says, I do not want to enjoy the goodness that God has given me, in effect is expressing a notion of ingratitude and a sense of derision towards the beauties of God's world, right? Hashem said everything is ketov, everything is good, and therefore one must enjoy, one must elevate. He gives a very striking analogy. He says the soul of a person is compared to a king. And a king has many, many servants whose purpose it is to carry out the missions and the directives of the king. Like all of the subjects of the king are in effect the king's servants. So consequently, he says, the faculties of the body are the servants that are there to serve the soul. The soul wants to do great things in the world, but the soul can do those things only if the body carries them out. So just as it would be true, it would be a wise counsel for a king to treat his help well, right? Pay your servants well, be sure that they eat enough and sleep enough and have good clothing. So too, one must treat the body well, because it is the body that is the emissary for carrying out the designs and purposes and goals of a soul. Because a soul that is not embodied, literally, within a body, will be incapable of doing the mitzvot and the like. So, once again, obviously, Rav Yehuda HaLevi is not necessarily glorifying pleasure as something intrinsically valuable, but at least it's a method of placating the servants so that the soul's mission will be able to be carried out. Of course, it's interesting that we do find in rabbinic literature a certain tension here, a certain ambivalence regarding the extent to which one should be involved in material possessions and pleasures. For example, that same passage in the Talmud says the Nazir is a sinner, or the Torah says the Nazir has to bring a sacrifice. So one passage in the Talmud says that's because he's sinful by abstaining from wine, which is a legitimate pleasure. And yet Nachmanides writes that the Nazir is a sinner because in spite of his having reached the sublime level of abstention, he wants to go back to regular life. In other words, remember, the Nazir brings the Korban at the end of the Nazirut. So according to Nachmanides, the sin of the Nazir is not in becoming a Nazir. The sin of the Nazir is in wanting to leave the exalted state of Kedusha. So we see already that certain type of idea of whether is it better on a higher level to abstain, or is it better to indulge and to enjoy. And of course, we do find in Chazal many statements regarding prishut. Prishut is separation. Maimonides himself, although he advocates the middle way, the path of moderation, but Maimonides constantly kind of denigrates the physical world to a large degree. But that, again, that's consistent with Maimonides' view that the goal of all life is ultimately intellectual comprehension of divinity, which, by the way, Rav Yehuda HaLevi, although obviously he wrote before Maimonides, he actually knocks very, very explicitly. He says, philosophers have an awful mistake, but they say that the goal of human existence is the activation of the intellect. That's a point that Rita Levi strongly, strongly disagrees with. But be it as it may, we find in Chazal a certain sense of ambivalence. But I think the simple idea to this is, it's not inherently an ambivalence. It's just a recognition of the dangers that a given path may lead to. Meaning, in an ideal way, one should enjoy life. One should derive pleasure from life in the sense of fostering appreciation to God and enabling the body to carry out the spiritual missions of the soul. The ambivalence that we find is simply the fact that an indulgence in the material world could very easily lead to a hedonistic type of philosophy, and it could destroy a person's sensitivity to spiritual things. You know, it's been commented a number of times that, although some say it's not 100% true, but it's often assumed that children, let's say, read less today because of things like computer games and television and the like. And why would, as it were, computer games and television override reading? You know, why don't people watch television less because they read? And part of the idea is, because of the notion of instant gratification, that we are creatures who seek out the path of least resistance, instant gratification, and that which gives us feedback with a minimal amount of investment is something we'll gravitate to towards something else that requires, as opposed to something else that requires investing our minds and our efforts in a stronger and more intensive way. So reading William Faulkner might be much more rewarding than John Gresham or watching something on television. And nevertheless, many people would prefer the John Gresham because it's simply faster. And you don't have to reread the page five times to be able to understand what on earth the guy's talking about. So the thing is, if we do live in a world of instant gratification, right? If something doesn't work, you throw it away, whatever it is, then by definition, the more we become addicted to the material pleasure, which gives a person a very, very quick type of fix, the less we become sensitive to spiritual pleasures, which by definition entail investments and work and commitments. So the Chachamim were very, very acutely aware, and that's why ambivalence is not necessarily contradiction. People say, oh, we have one statement that says this and one statement that says this. It's not really a contradiction, it's simply a reflection of the genuine ambiguities and ambivalences that one faces. That on one level, the world is here for us to enjoy and for us to grow in our spiritual appreciation of God. At the other level, when we're over-invested in it, it blunts our sensitivities and we become addicted to instant gratification instead of the thing that requires work and efforts and gradualism in trying to achieve. Even the spiritual world, as it is presently described in popular culture, is an instant gratification spiritual world. The whole concept of New Age religion and the concept of, the Protestants have a good term for it, they call it cheap grace, which is a very, very evocative term. The concept of, you know, I'll get my religion cheap, I'll get my religion fast, I'll get it in sound bites, with instant nirvana and instant gratification, as opposed to the notion of a long, gradual, difficult process in which one struggles. But if one becomes addicted to that type of thinking, it's very hard to go back in the other way. And consequently, our Chachamim do urge, on one hand, appreciation of life, enjoying physical pleasure, not withdrawing from it. Many of the mitzvot are connected to physical pleasure. Having the meals of Shabbat, when there was a Beit HaMikdash, eating korbanot was a mitzvah. And yet, at the same time, they do stress a certain direction towards the simplicity of a lifestyle, towards not accumulating too many possessions, not letting things become a master over you. I remember, I don't remember if Pepsi still has this, but there was a little logo on the Pepsi Cola bottles, which kind of encapsulated American consumerist culture. It said, drink Pepsi, get stuff. The kinds of get stuff, you know, That's the idea, just to get stuff. And what do they say, who has the most toys at the end of the race wins. So this is why the Chachamim go back and forth on this, because the truth of the matter is both have to be kept in perspective. And this is ultimately Maimonides' idea of the middle way, simply because you could veer to any extreme. Yeah.
Well,
thinking about the Nazir and having to bring a sacrifice, I'm a little bit confused about when Hashem recreated the world after the flood. The only change he really made is allowing us to eat meat. And yet today, we seem to have a feeling that vegetarianism is closer to what God wants.
Mm-hmm. Well, not everyone says that, but yeah.
I'm sorry, a lot of vegetarians
yes.
say that.
Uh-huh. Right.
Is that ambivalence? Is that...
Well, again, I mean, there is a little ambivalence here because the question is how to read the record, meaning to say, in the sense of the ideal world that existed when Adam was created, we do find that the idea was not to take the life of animal creatures and to live off the plants. A change occurred in the aftermath of the flood. So the proponents of vegetarianism argue that in the ideal system of morality that God had wanted the world to be predicated on, the notion was not to take animal life. God conceded, as it were, to the weaknesses of human nature and kind of allowed us to eat meat. So their argument is, however, that it is a vice that one should try to surmount. I mean, that this is the basis of their argument, given the fact that it was the ideal that existed. Now, the counter-argument is that it was the ideal for a different plane of existence, one which was no longer relevant to the situation of the human effort. But the question really becomes, what is the implication of the before and the after? Do we strive to realize the before, the before type of universe, although we inhabit the after type of universe? Or is the concept that what was before is really beyond us, and that's a messianic idea? But even so, Rav Kook does write, you know, Rav Kook was absolutely not a vegetarian, and this is a very common misconception. Rav Kook didn't eat a lot of meat because Rav Kook didn't eat a lot of food. I mean, Rav Kook was a tzaddik who was not involved in these things, and he was also poor, as every Jew in Israel essentially was in those days. But Rav Kook did have meat on Shabbos and Yom Tov, so there's no question about that. But Rav Kook at the same time does write that with the coming of the Messianic era, once again, that's what it says in Isaiah, the famous verse, the lamb will lie down with the lion, those famous verses. And the concept is that we will revert. Even animals will not be carnivorous. Like lions will eat straw, and therefore how much more so will human beings not. But again, Rav Kook says that will be a reflection of a heightened moral sensitivity that exists in the world, which is not yet the case. Meaning to say, people who are still brutal to people, whether it be physical, or whether it be with anger, or whether it be with jealousy, their vegetarianism would not be that reflection. The vegetarian is supposed to be the reflection of a heightened sensitivity to life. But until it mirrors that heightened sensitivity, it's not necessarily a spiritually significant gesture. Again, I don't want to prove anything from anecdote, you know, if there was a vegetarian, whatever, that's not but the point is, what that does show you in a very, you know, obviously a very aberrant case, is that vegetarianism per se does not translate automatically into any type of moral refinement. And the dangers that are pointed out is, when one becomes hypersensitive in one particular area, since there will tend to be a neglect of other areas. In fact, this is true even in religious stringencies. One who tends to be excessively strict in one area might do so at the expense of others. And there is a real fear that if the moral compass gets directed to the vegetarian issue, it may cause a correspondingly benign neglect towards other issues. But at the same time, the Chachamim do have statements about not eating a lot of meat. They talk about the idea that meat should be for Shabbat and Yom Tov. It should be in moderation, both for health reasons and for spiritual reasons. So there is this concept of great moderation in this, beyond what is practiced in America today. Say again, how will it be Kabbanat?
That's
a big problem. I believe he says the Kabbanot will consist of burnt offerings. In other words, he doesn't say Kabbanot will be abolished, because Kabbanot, in a Kabbalistic way, are actually seen as beneficial to the animal. It releases the animal soul to a higher level of spiritual exaltation. But in terms of human consumption, there would be less of a need for that. But you see, that's always the question. you try to bring messianic overtones into existence when you're not yet in the age of the Messiah. That's really the issue of vegetarianism. The concept once again is therefore that, and of course, the idea of enjoying the physical world and not being over connected. I mean, the Kuzari's mashal is a very, very fine mashal, because what he's saying is physicality and materialism have to be our servants and not our masters. Remember this is the analogy he's given to us. Our soul and our minds are our kings, and all of those physical things are our slaves. We have to own our possessions under God's rule, but we can't let our possessions own us. And here is the danger, where one gets so addicted to a particular lifestyle, a particular way of living. You know, even, and this is something that's relevant to my situation as well. A person says, can't make Aliyah, can't live in Israel, because I just won't have everything I have here. Right? Common feeling. Maybe people don't always say it that way. But, you know, that's often the thought that goes through people's minds. The question becomes, you know, have we become, you know, Israel is not like it was, you know, 50 years ago. You know, you live in a smaller apartment and everything else, but... And yet, the truth of the matter is, we do become very, very taluy on what we own. And instead of the idea of the soul being the master over the things sometimes become the master over the soul. And yet, at the same time, the Chachamim expressed the other idea that a person needs a bayit no'eh, he needs a nice, spacious home, kelim no'im, a nice clothing. And what that does is, nice things, marchivin dato shel adam. It expands a person's mind. It gives the person an ability to think more clearly, to absorb Hashem more clearly. Right? So there's always this going back and forth in all of these things. Let me share with you a thought of a great Hasidic master, many, many hundreds of years later than the Kuzari, Rav Tzadok of Lublin. I think I probably have quoted him before, was a great Hasidic rabbi. He died in 1900, right at the dawn of the 20th century, or maybe the end of the 19th century, since 1901 is the end of the 20th century. And he was considered to be really one of the greatest, perhaps the greatest Talmudic scholar among the Hasidic rabbis of his time, again, a profound mystic. In fact, he became a rebbe very late in life. Most of his life he was... silent, so to speak. He did not do any public teaching, but he was just a phenomenal scholar. And he points out, if you look at the Ten Commandments, this is in the book of Exodus chapter 20, and there's the great scene of Matan Torah before the Ten Commandments are given. So it describes there being thunder and lightning and all sorts of sound effects and visual effects, like the Cecil B. DeMille, the Ten Commandments. So it talks about there were kolotes. Kolot is thunder, uvrakim, and flashes of lightning. And then God gives the Ten Commandments. And then at the end it says that the people are afraid and they're still looking at the kolot v'lapidim, the thunder and the torches, fire, vision of fire. So Rav Tzadok points out there is a very subtle distinction between what is described before they got the Ten Commandments and what is described after they got the Ten Commandments. That before they got the Ten Commandments, what they visualized were flashes of lightning. The word is barakim. After they got the Ten Commandments, they no longer perceive flashes of lightning, they perceive torches in the sky. Right? A lot of people, you wouldn't even notice this necessarily. Rav Tzadok says that this difference in visualization was symbolic of a spiritual transformation that occurred in the psyche of the Jewish soul, pre-Matan Torah and after Matan Torah. Even before the Torah was given, human beings had a desire for spirituality, a desire for holiness, a desire for communion and connection with a divine power that is greater than themselves. Right? That is, in fact, the origin of idolatry, Maimonides writes, was a desire to be connected in some way. However, that type of holiness is symbolized by flashes of lightning. Because the only type of way people could connect to God was by separating themselves from their physicality and materiality to the greatest degree they could do. Meaning, you become holy by celibacy, by becoming celibate. You become holy by fasting. You become holy by lying down on a bed of nails. Because the concept of holiness that was prevalent in the world, and that at least that classic Catholicism later took over in various other religions as well, is that the world was inherently an evil place. The world was a place whose materiality existed in contradiction to God. And one becomes holy only to the extent you disengage from this world and you separate. So a holy person takes a vow of celibacy, chastity, poverty, whatever it might be, fasting. And in the Catholic tradition, although it's downplayed much today, the ideal was indeed the hermits who dwelt away from people and rejected the world and tried to destroy and mortify the body to whatever degree possible. Rav Tzadok says, that idea of holiness is symbolized by lightning. Because what is lightning? Lightning is a brilliant flash of light that then dies down and plunges you into total darkness. Because if your holiness depends on disengagement, by definition, it can only be transient or ephemeral. Because the hermit has to eat sometimes. He has to go to the bathroom, has to sleep. There's no possible way you can retain that permanent connection with God if your connection depends on your disengagement from this world. Because ultimately you're going to be pulled back. And therefore, the life of the hermit, so to speak, will be moments of extreme ecstasy punctuated by despair and darkness till the next round of ecstasy comes back. Well, you see a similar philosophy. That's right. But the Qumran sect, however they're identified, were really a breakaway sect from the normative Judaism, which developed what's called Pharisaic Judaism, Talmudic Judaism. That's correct. So Rav Tzadok is reading this into the Matan Torah situation. Now, that is what lightning is. The Torah taught the Jewish people a new idea of holiness. That holiness does not depend on separation, renunciation, rejection. Holiness can exist by integrating the world, by sanctifying the world. That the world is not inherently evil. Now, one can debate whether we view the world as inherently holy by virtue of Kito, God's statement, or we view the world as neutral. I mean, one can go either way in this. But certainly we do not view that there's some inherent evil in the world. And consequently, by eating, drinking, marrying, having families, earning money, if one does so with the correct moral sense and obedience to the laws of the Torah, one elevates and sanctifies the material and connects with Hashem even in the middle of all of that material activity. That type of thing is compared to a torch. Now, if Tzadok points out, what is the difference in visualization between the torch and the lightning? The lightning is a brilliant flash of lights, but you're then plunged into total darkness. The torch is not as bright. The torch flickers. It's not as powerful, but it is a constant. He says it might very well be that the ecstatic rush you get by separating from the world, not talking to people, sitting on a flagpole for 100 days or 360 days, you might get spiritual visions and spiritual insights that might give you a bigger rush and a bigger high than the daily mundane effort of dealing with other people and trying to live a decent life. But ultimately, through the torch, you get warmth, you get guidance, you get direction. You have to navigate a dangerous and tortuous mountain road. You're driving up near Tzfat, let's say. It's going to be very hard to do it. Well, it'll be hard to do it no matter what, but it's going to be impossible to do it with a lightning flash. Because the lightning only gives you a second, but you're not going to see where the next thing is. With a torch, you can make your way. And therefore, Rav Tzadok says, in a sense, this is almost a tragic compromise. Because condemning the soul to live in the world means, by definition, that the ultimate experiences will lose in some of their intensity and strength, because they will be diluted with confrontation with the baser elements of creation. And yet, That is precisely the human mission, to elevate and to sanctify every corner of God's existence, or every corner of God's creation. That is why the word Olam, we said many times, Olam, the world, the shorish of Olam is Ayin Lamed Mem, which is a Hebrew shorish meaning to hide or conceal. The world, the physical world, is a world of concealment. It is a world of possibility. But the possibilities have not been actualized. The possibilities are hidden potentials. Potentials which are not visible, which are not apparent. But through our confrontation with them, we can elevate them. And by the way, this is why Rabbi Halevi writes in the fourth gate, that he says, as I've mentioned before, the philosophers have it wrong when they say that the purpose of human existence is to develop the mental faculty of the human being so that the passive intellect, so to speak, gets reunited with the active intellect, and then you achieve full intellectual comprehension. Because in their view, see, their view of morality even was, and the Rabbi Halevi says, yes, philosophers say you got to be moral, but merely because they believe that was a mechanism that would facilitate understanding. In other words, morality is a good policy, like Benjamin Franklin said, it's good to be moral because that way you'll make more money because people will trust you. So Franklin predicated morality on the pragmatic concern of good business. The philosophers predicate morality on the pragmatic basis, it'll improve your mind, right, so to speak, in the sense that they talked about it. But Yehuda Halevi says, no, the point is not to develop your mind with morality simply being an instrument towards that end, which perhaps even Maimonides might say, but rather it is intrinsically the instrument by which we transform the physicality of creation by bringing out the potentials of godliness that are within the creation. And this, of course, was an idea, although Yehuda Halevi is not writing from the technical perspective of a mystic, of a mekubal, but these were ideas certainly that were tremendously important in the development of Kabbalah in terms of, that's why Kabbalah developed, for example, all sorts of eating rituals, all sorts of things, you know, connected to the physical world, because this was a way of releasing the hidden sparks of godliness within the physical world. And Rav Tzadok sees this as the transition from the notion of the lightning flash to the torch.
You find that time the times of Davos or Hard, which is the torch, and the Avraham Avinu, and then the school of Shem Eva.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like the two schools follow similar analogy to what you're talking mm-hmm. about. The Shem and Eva, there were attachments of the county, attachments of the outside world.
Right.
So there you just study, you know, right. And Avraham Avinu, he's always connected to mm-hmm. you know,
right, and of course, as you know, Chazal say that, you know, the world is divided into a, you know, we say there could be up to six full millennia until we have Mashiach. So the way the Gemara describes the chronology is the first 2,000 years are years of confusion without a direct guidance. The second 2,000 years are the years of Torah being developed and taught. And the third 2,000 years, which we're in, of course, right now, are the years of the potential coming of Mashiach. So if you look at the Cheshvan of the Gemara, you see that the year 2000, which is the beginning of the age of Torah, does not begin from Sinai, but it begins when Avraham Avinu was 52 years old. Okay, that's when he began teaching. So it corresponds very nicely that if the Torah is teaching sanctification of the physical, this was the avoda of Avraham Avinu, which begins the 2,000 years of Torah. In fact, the Maharal says, just to take this thought a little further, and again, excuse me for going a little bit beyond the strict medieval period, but again, there is, you know, these are sharp, these are not sharp divisions. The Maharal, for example, in particular, the Maharal was in the 1500s, and he was a major transition figure between medieval philosophy, the Renaissance, and Kabbalah, mysticism, all at the same time. These were currents that were operating here. And the Maharal explains a Talmudic passage in a very fascinating way. The Talmud points out, without giving any significance to this at all, that there are many aspects of Matan Torah that are connected to the number 3. How is this? The Torah was given to a threefold nation. This is what the Talmud says. Kohanim, Leviim, Yisraelim. The written Torah, or the Tanakh, has 3 parts. Torah, Neviim, Ketuvim. The Jewish people are a threefold nation. It was given in the 3rd month, because Sivan, you count from Nisan, is the 1st month. So Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, 3rd month. It was given after 3 days of preparation. So the Talmud simply says, without telling you why that's important, that everything about the Torah is connected to the number 3. So the Maharal, one of the things the Maharal likes to do is the Maharal is heavy into numerological symbolism. He considers numbers to have a great symbolic message. And in his understanding, the number 3 always suggests a triangle, a 3-point shape. And a triangle represents 2 extremities that are synthesized or united at the apex of a triangle. Right? You have 2 opposites, 2 points that move in opposite directions that somehow get harmonized, right? The thesis, the antithesis, and the synthesis. So 3 is the number that represents the synthesis of that which would otherwise exist in dichotomy or contradiction. And he says that's exactly what Torah is. Because the human being is body and spirit. The human being is material and spiritual. Without a Torah, these forces would exist in a never-ending contradiction with no way of reconciliation. That would be the lightning flash. Because my spiritual life could only be met by disengagement from the world. But then there are the demands of the body that pull me away from that. Torah creates the apex of the triangle, where the unification of body and spirit allows even the needs of the body to become needs of the spirit. And that is why so much of Matan Torah is connected to the number 3. Now, once again, there is a statement in the Gemara which may indicate that this ability to bring Kedusha to the physical world may be indeed a unique Jewish endowment. The Talmud discusses the following question. It mentions that non-Jews are allowed to bring korbanot to the temple. And this is absolutely true. We have a Beit HaMikdash. Non-Jews bring korbanot as well as Jews. But there's an opinion in the Talmud that says non-Jews are allowed to bring the olots and not the shlamim. Now, what's an olot? Remember, an olah is the korban that is totally burnt on the altar. The shlamim is an offering which is threefold. Parts of the animal, peace offering. Parts of the animal are burnt on the altar. Parts of the animal are eaten by the person bringing the korban. And parts of the animal are eaten by the kohen, who sacrifices the korban. So what is the idea? The olah is the idea of total surrender to God. Giving up everything. Giving it over to God. The notion of not keeping anything for your material self. The shlamim, in which you eat and you enjoy, is the concept of consecrating even the eating and physical animalistic part of yourself. So he says that, so some explain the Talmudic passage, that with respect to the non-Jew, indeed, their highest level of holiness might involve renunciation, surrender. That is the olah. But the Jewish person, through the Torah, is given the capacity of sanctifying even the physical and animalistic. I'm not sure how a vegetarian would answer that question fully, but there is certainly in classic Jewish thought, even the sources that do support vegetarianism vis-a-vis the human being do regard the korban as something that is a proper action of homage, act of homage to God, simply because it's you're elevating the animal soul by bringing it as a korban to God. Well, but I think the proof of the pudding is simply this. Not pudding, but the proof of it is this: when Cain and Abel gave sacrifices. Now, on one level, this is before the flood. So before the flood, they were vegetarians. Nonetheless, it says very specifically that Hevel gave a korban to God from his sheep.
So just looking at that alone, textually alone, that seems to be indicative that even at a time when vegetarianism was considered to be the obligatory manner of life for a human being, the idea of korban, animal korbanot, was still considered prevalent. Of course, that gives rise to another question. If you remember, we did discuss a few weeks ago Maimonides' idea that korbanot were simply given as a concession to the idolatrous, to wean us away from the barbaric practices of the Canaanites. Remember, in other words, you know, better the sheep than your son, right? The concept was that way. And of course, one of the big questions on Maimonides is, you see that there was no idolatry in those days yet, and Hevel goes ahead and brings a korban, and God accepts it, and God gets pleasure from it. So there are problems now, but you do see...
Yeah.
Kind of, you're saying it's kind of a human sacrifice of part of yourself.
Right.
That's interesting. I did not hear that explanation.
Don't kill your son, don't sacrifice your son, kill the animal, and then circumcise your
kid. Uh-huh. That's an interesting connection. I have to see if that's quoted. But that's an interesting idea that it's part of a korban that you're giving to God of your son. Yeah, but be it as it may, there are certainly Rishonim like the Rambam that learn korbanot as a secondary level, but again, it's very difficult to reconcile with much of what we see. Yeah.
Even earlier, prior to the flood, one wasn't allowed to kill an animal to eat it,
mm-hmm.
but if an animal is already dead, there was nothing wrong with eating it.
That's true also, yeah. That's
I would sway away from saying that, that the Torah has a vegetarian agenda here.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the eating of the animal per se, taking
of
life.
Well, okay. Well, it depends how you define the vegetarian agenda, though. I mean, although for hygienic reasons, I don't think vegetarians would advocate eating dead animals that just died in the street. But in terms of their moral objections, I think their moral objections are largely to the taking of life. But that's a religious philosophy. But the vegetarian, I think, is primarily, other than the health issues, is primarily predicated for an idea of not taking life. Now, this can come to some very absurd things. You know, there are those who call for the abolition of what is called species discrimination or speciesism, in which all life. I guess they don't include plant life. I guess I haven't heard anyone that says you can't eat vegetable rights. That would really... Although there is something. I don't remember. There's something beyond vegan. You know, vegan doesn't eat eggs and fish. But there's something beyond... They only eat things that, like fruit, which grows back every year. Anything that you have to replant. Yeah. There are certain distinctions among extreme vegans in which they will not eat certain vegetables because you're destroying it. Okay, so there are even there vegetarian life and the like, but there was a petition that a bunch of people signed and they did that we reject any idea that one species is superior to another species, and we're exactly the same. Now the strange thing about this is this goes back to Rav Cook's point that when you become overly hyper moral sensitive in one area, it tends to degrade your sensibility in other areas. One of the outstanding proponents of animal liberation is the Australian Jewish philosopher Peter Singer, who now is heading something in Princeton, the Bioethics Institute in Princeton. And Peter Singer is famous for two things. Number one, he's a very ardent animal liberationist. And number two, he's in favor of killing defective newborn babies. On the grounds that they don't contribute. We're not talking about abortion. I'm talking about after they're born. On the grounds that they're a drain on society. So it's an interesting idea that the one who has the great compassion, in other words, equating humans to animals often doesn't always mean that the animal gets elevated. It often means the human gets degraded. And it's interesting that there's a correlation here. But again, it goes back to Rav Cook's point that if you take the idea that man is animal, or animal is man, then indeed that can have all sorts of negative consequences. Now, the Jewish tradition, of course, is against causing pain to animals. Right? Causing pain to an animal is a Torah prohibition. And if somebody were to tell me that I am a vegetarian because I protest or I don't want to have a part of the way veal, or the way calves are penned up, or, you know, not being allowed to move, or the way chickens are treated. That is an absolutely legitimate moral response, because, granted, the Torah says we can kill animals, but we can kill animals for human consumption, but that's supposed to be in a swift, painless way. And any mistreatment of animals prior to that point of swift and painless death is a Torah violation. And if it's a Torah violation, one can indeed take a moral principle stance within the framework of halacha and say, I don't want to support that. Right? I'm not going to wear fur if the mink are trapped in those painful iron teeth. Right? So that is perfectly fine. The only thing is, if one takes the position, I am a vegetarian because I think it is immoral for the life of an animal to be taken for human consumption, that would appear to be second-guessing the judgment of God, which says it's done. You see? But on the other hand, all the other stuff that's associated with it, that's perfectly within the moral compass that one can make those. One can make the judgment, certainly for health reasons, one can certainly make judgments.
And the movement is called Echo Kosher. It's called Echo Kosher.
Right, I know, yeah, yeah. Well, okay, it's, well, you know, it's
minimal
interesting.
Minimal impact, minimal pesticides.
Well, once again, I don't know if I'd use the word kosher, because kosher has a halachic meaning. It's not a term that we use for things, you know, we don't like. But nevertheless, the concept, you know, environmental consciousness, animal experimentation is another example, right? There certainly is. So first of all, the people who are against animal experimentation have wound up killing quite a few human beings as a result. They've blown up places. They're very. Some of them are really domestic terrorists in the interest of that greater cause. But certainly, Judaism recognizes there's a big difference between testing a cancer drug and testing a deodorant by blinding an animal's eyes. That where the need is a relatively trivial, insignificant need, and you're causing an animal suffering, you're not allowed to do that. On the other hand, if it's something that could save a human life and there's no lesser intrusive way of doing it, regretfully, halacha would allow that to be done. You know, so there's a balance here. I mean, Judaism is, as it tends to be, people say, oh, it's wishy-washy. You never take a strong side. Abortion, right? It's not murder, but it's not right. You know. But the answer is that Judaism is in fact, a very, very reasonable approach, and usually it balances things. It does not veer to these extremes. It does not see the world in either-or categories, because it tends to understand that there are values at stake that have to be dealt with. There is a value in saving a human life. There's a value in sparing animals' pain. We try to do both. When you cannot do both, then you have to prioritize, and then there's a system of priorities. Well, that's very true. That pertains to how God relates to animals. So the Maimonides thesis is...
Also relate to our, we're not allowed to wipe out entire species.
No, that's right. But nevertheless, that's true. In other words, according to Maimonides, there's no prohibition in killing an animal. But nevertheless, there is a prohibition in causing pain to an animal. And that is indeed on the individual level, because animals are sentient, are feeling beings. And in fact, you know, there are halachas. If you have a pet, for example, I wanted to digress for a moment, the halacha is you are supposed to feed your pet before you eat yourself. And this is based on the pasuk in Shema, where God promises, if you keep the commandments, I will give you grass for your animals, and you will eat, and you will be satisfied. You know, first, the animal has to be satisfied, and then you.
How do we understand, in light of saying that, you know, that in Judaism the ideal is to integrate both physical and spiritual, so like situations like, say, like Rav Shimon bar Yochai and his son,
mm-hmm.
who went away into a cave for a number of years.
Right.
And look at somebody like the Vilna Gaon, who was, what they say, I mean, did some things that they say about him,
mm-hmm.
the amount that he slept, ate, and et cetera, in light of this idea.
Again, it seems to be, in fact, that this is the whole idea that the Hanhaga, the behavior of Shimon bar Yochai, was not considered to be the proper behavior for other people. And in fact, the Gemara says, many tried to emulate him, and they were not successful. And part of the idea is that we sometimes have to have role models and visions of people who reach the highest level of spirituality to show us how we could try to raise our world as well. We need to say, that these are the exceptions, just like Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu also did not live with his wife, right? But that's not, it's a difficult thing. How can you have a role model that you're not supposed to emulate in a particular way? But at least it shows us the human potential of Kedusha in the world. And so this was just something, the idea of sanctifying the physical is a very unique contribution of Judaism. And as I say, it's based on rabbinic sources, even Torah sources and the like, but the Kuzari is one of the first that articulates it in some detail. And he includes in this the notion of joy in life, which is also a very interesting thing, because he points out that philosophers sometimes thought you have to be serious, you have to look somber all the time. Yeah, he says kind of, he really, I don't know exactly who the philosopher is. Now, you almost imagine that he's talking to Maimonides, but I know that can't be the case. Maimonides didn't write anything yet. But he says, you know, you don't have to be so serious and so somber, and one can get pleasure in life and not look at life as a burden, because ultimately one will not be able to achieve connection with God unless one does so out of a sense of out of a sense of joy. And once again, although he doesn't quote everything he says, he doesn't document it with a reference to Chazal, but our Chachamim say that Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration, can rest on a person only when they're in a state of joy and happiness. That when there is sadness, the Ruach HaKodesh does not come from a person. And that is why David used to play the harp for Shaul. Shaul was prone to depression or whatever, however we understand it, and the music cheered him up and enabled him to be connected with God. That was the idea that Chazal said. Okay, now the next thing, and again, I'm just kind of just covering the high points in the third essay. The next point the Kuzari deals with is the role of prayer. And here he uses the very beautiful and famous analogy, this is one of another famous passage, that prayer is food for the soul. Prayer is nutrition. Prayer is the ability to connect with God, which the soul needs. A person without prayer is a starving person. The soul is depleted, the soul is not getting its nourishment. And here, he makes the point, and that is why typically there are three tefillot a day, just as it's customary for the body to take in its nutrition three times a day. And this itself brings a very interesting idea, because this is an idea that again is developed in Hasidic literature at more at greater length. And that is the idea that the purpose of prayer, well, just to remind us of this, if you remember with Yosef Albo, a later philosopher, but we had read this excerpt earlier, when he discusses the idea of prayer, makes the point that the efficacy of prayer is not because it changes God's mind. After all, number one, it certainly doesn't inform God of anything, because God knows the information before we give it to him. So it does not serve the purpose of information. It also does not serve the purpose of changing God's mind, because God, by definition, cannot really change his mind. And the reason is a bit technical, but that is because if something is in a state of absolute perfection, how can it change? If it changes, you're either saying what it was a minute ago was not perfect and now it's perfect, or what it was a minute ago is perfect and now it's imperfect. Change is not possible in perfection. So if we reject the idea that prayer is informational, and we reject the idea that prayer changes God's mind, so Rav Albo concludes that the efficacy of prayer is because of self-transformation. I become transformed through my prayer, by recognizing my dependence on God, by recognizing my vulnerability, by coming in a deeper contact with who I am and what I am and what God is in my life. I now stand in relationship to God on a different plane, and therefore the way God dealt with me before prayer is not, in other words, I'm different. So God deals with X in a certain way, God deals with Y in a different way. It's not God that's changed, it's the transformation of X to Y that has changed. Now again, that doesn't mean on a superficial level you'll get what you asked for, but however God answers prayers in many ways. God answers prayers with a no, God answers prayers with giving a person the strength to go on. However God answers the prayer, the foundational concept behind the efficacy of prayer, says Rav Albo, is self-transformation and metamorphosis. Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, 19th century Germany, who he doesn't quote Alba, but he makes the same point, says this is implicit in the very Hebrew term for prayer, the most common Hebrew term for prayer, which is Lehitz Palel, because of the following consideration. The Shoresh of Lehitz Palel is Pei Lamed Lamed, Palel. Palel actually means to judge or to evaluate. In the Chumash we find that a Shofet or Shoftim are called Palilim, those who adjudicate. Now, Lehitz Palel is the Hitz Palel, which is a reflexive. It's a verb that reflects back to yourself. Like Lehitz Rachet is to wash yourself. Right? So, Lehitz Palel, which we translate to pray, really means to engage in a process of self-introspection, self-evaluation, self-judgment. Well, yes, indeed. Of course, your point is 100% valid. And this highlights the idea that one has to know what they're saying. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily, although now with translations it's not so difficult, that one has to know what they are saying on a word-to-word basis. One can have a meaningful prayer experience even if it's all Greek to you, all Hebrew to you, right? You don't know what you're saying, but you do have to know that you are talking to God and you're asking God to help you to be self-transformative, right? So there is a concept of kavanah. There is kavanah. kavana in the specific sense. One can have kavana without knowing all the specifics, although one's prayer is deeply enriched with one's understanding. By the way, there's a very excellent book. A fellow that grew up in my community of West Hartford wrote a book. It's called Kavana. It's an English book. It's around 600 pages. And he goes through all the different approaches of what does mean kavana means, intention, direction, focus. And he goes to the different definitions of tefillah and the efficacy of prayer, self-transformation. He goes into these ideas in a very, very clear, clear way. But be it as it may, that's the famous Rav Yosef Albo and Rav Hirsch, Lehit Paleo. I become changed. God does not change, but I change in my relationship to God. That's one point. But the Kuzari is taking it a different way. See, Rav Albo is still positing what you might call the Orthodox theology, that the purpose of prayer is to fill a need that I have, meaning I have a need. I need a child, I need health, I need wealth, I need parnassa. So I invoke prayer as a tool to get what I need. Rav Albo's only problem is, how does it get you what you need? Answer, by changing yourself. Rav Yudel Levy is making an opposite point. Prayer is not there to get you something that you need. Prayer is the need. The need of the human being is to pray. If it gets answered, that's always the answer. But if you get what you're praying for, that's fine. And if you don't, that's fine. It is prayer that is the need. Prayer is the food. Prayer is the food of the soul through that communion to God. Meaning, prayer is not a vehicle to get a need answered. Rather, it's the opposite. Sometimes God creates needs to force us into a stance of prayer. And in fact, this is supported by a passage in the Talmud that says, why were the Imahot, our matriarchs, why were they akarot? Why were they childless? Why were they barren women? So listen to what the Gemara says. The Gemara says, Mipnei, right? Sarah didn't have children. Rivka didn't have children, right? Rachel didn't have children. Leah was fortunate in that regard. So the Gemara answers, Mipnei shakadosh baruch hu mitaveh b'tfilatan shel tzadikim. Because God was desirous of hearing their prayer. God wanted their prayer. God wanted to create a situation where they would turn to Him, they would interrelate, they would interconnect. Meaning, God creates needs. Because without the need, we wouldn't always be aware of the inner need. The real need is tefillah. But without the outer need, we're sometimes not aware of that. So God creates needs in life so that we turn to Him in prayer, which is the real need. And in fact, it's almost the idea sometimes, if a person gets everything they want without prayer, that's considered to be a sign of divine dissatisfaction. As if, imagine somebody was benudging you at your office and your home, they want money out of you. So you just don't want to talk to them, you know, they just bother you. So you might tell somebody, just give that person what he wants, get him out of here. Okay? That's not a sign of love. That's a sign of rejection. I actually read a story. This is a true story. This is really a horrible story about a 16-year-old boy in Israel who his mother died and his father got remarried. And for whatever crazy reason, his stepmother could not stand the 16-year-old. Could not stand the 16-year-old. And she refused to live in the house with him. So the father was very wealthy. So the father calls the kid over. He says, I got you an apartment. Here's a credit card. Here are the keys to a car. You have my credit card. You can use it for anything you want. I just cannot see you again. And some say that that is the mashal of the notion of, if the main thing in one's life is that relationship, not having that relationship is a much, much greater tragedy than whatever physical deprivations exist. And the Chiddushi Arim, the first Rebbe of Ger, actually interpreted this, this is the 19th century, actually interpreted this as the curse of the snake. In Genesis, the snake was cursed that you will crawl on your belly and you will eat dirt all the days of your life. Eat dust. I don't know if that's exact. I don't want to see you. I don't want to hear from you. Take what you want and don't bother me. that indeed is considered to be the greatest curse. So this is what the Khuzri is saying. Prayer is the food for the soul. Now, I would just take the analogy a little further. You know, a person can eat different types of food, right? A person can eat junk food, or a person can eat nutritious food. Now, if you eat junk food, you're not going to die. If a person would only eat candy, nothing else, they will not die, they will live. Okay? It's enough to keep them alive. But on the other hand, their system will not function very well. They'll be probably sickly, they won't be healthy. So too, with prayer. Prayer is food, but prayer could be nutritious food, or it could be junk food. You can have a junk food prayer. So if one prays superficially, without understanding, without commitment, without care, yeah, it's food. It keeps the neshama alive, but it doesn't really give it nutrition. And prayer is a hard thing. And prayer is a hard thing in a lot of levels. Prayer is hard, number one, because at least in the traditional sense, prayer is a fixed liturgy. And the danger of a fixed liturgy is always the idea of staleness. Right? Now, Maimonides writes in an interesting passage that originally prayer was intended to be spontaneous, fresh, and creative. Every person would pray in their own words, in their own way. Every prayer might be different. So you'd say prayer as you feel. But it was later thought that many people were not capable of that. They were not capable of coming up with noble and sublime thoughts, so there became a standardization of liturgy, simply because people were not always capable of that spontaneous creativity. However, the fixed nature of a liturgy creates its own dangers, and that is the staleness of repetition. So number one, it should be pointed out that many commentaries note that although Maimonides talks about the notion of the fixed prayer being added onto the spontaneous prayer, he did not mean to say that the fixed prayer supersedes spontaneous prayer. It is simply an added element that's superimposed, but spontaneous prayer is still a proper exercise. People should get into the habit, as it were, of the spontaneous praying to God in their own words, etc., and the like. There's also the difficult challenge of, can there be, and again, this is obviously among the different denominations, conservative, reform, orthodox, Reconstructionist, this is going to be a difficult issue, but all of them struggle with the same question, although they answer it very differently. And that is, what room for innovative creativity and individualism can there be in the context of a fixed liturgy? It's a very, very good question, which people will answer it in different ways. I don't want to get into specific answers, but certainly, even the most traditional person who believes you cannot change the Siddur at all still has to grapple with at least what psychological dimensions of creativity can I bring in saying the same words. Because otherwise the words don't feed me as well. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, well, okay, so we have, yeah, so there's maybe a missing link here, and the missing link is this. You're 100% correct. That is described as God's need. But what is God's need, ultimately? What does God need? So here we have to go back to the idea that, which is articulated in Rav Luzzatto's writings and the writings of the Ari, that God's only desire was to confer upon us something that is beneficial to our souls. So therefore, implicit in God's desire to hear our prayers is because prayer is what feeds our soul. It's connected. Because that is God's desire. God's desire is altruistic in that sense. That brings up another important idea. You know, it says that it is not good, right? The famous parsha of the creation of man and woman. So God says, it is not good for man to be alone. Let me make him a helpmate to be opposite him. This is the creation of Chava, of Eve. So the Torah, and one of the medieval commentaries, raises the question, what's so bad for man to be alone? He's in the Garden of Eden at this point. There's been no sin. He has everything he wants. What is so bad to be alone? So the Torah says the following. Because when man is alone in the Garden of Eden, he has everything that he wants to take. Everything is there for the taking. But he has no one to whom to give. Now man is godly. And in order to actualize the godliness within a person, one must emulate the attributes of God which are given, because God has nothing that he needs from us. So everything that God demands is ultimately for our good. So consequently, it is not good for man to be alone, because man without a helpmate is only a taker and not a giver. And a person who takes and does not give is not godly. Meaning, God's impulse is altruistic in that sense. Now, this is an amazing idea. So if we ask ourselves, why did God create marriage? God created marriage so that human beings who would otherwise be selfish, egotistical, and preoccupied with self should become godly by actualizing their capacity to give to another. And so marriage is not there to satisfy my needs. So in other words, you don't enter a marriage to get something out of it. You enter a marriage, well, you do get something out of it. You get into a marriage to get something out of it by becoming a more godly person, by learning to selflessly give to someone else. Right? Because God's impulse is giving. So if we say, going back to your question, HaKadosh Baruch Hu mitaveh, the mitaveh is so we will get the gift of the closeness of his presence. And well, that's right. That's right. That's right. So prayer is a very hard thing. Prayer is a hard thing because we don't always have the noble feelings. But the point is, you know, there are things that you can do. Here we go back to even meditation and other types of techniques can help a person. Part of our problem is that we're always, but often we're in a rush. You know, we walk into the middle of a service or whatever it is, and we got to find the right page and everything else. We don't take the time to invest in the art of prayer. Yeah.
The slow readers have a real problem.
You're raising a serious question. A serious question that I don't have a 100% good answer for. But part of it is, you know, one can sit down with a halakhic authority and go through the fact that maybe some things don't always have to be said. That maybe a certain amount of reduction can exist even within the halakhic structure, which would allow a person to focus, to focus more. That undoubtedly can be the case. Well, yeah. I mean, and the truth is, the pace of the congregational prayers is just absurdly quick. I mean, there's no.
Prayers are all out loud.
Sfardim do say it word for word for word. Of course, it does take much longer. I know myself. I mean, I hate to say it. That in Israel, I would often daven Sephardic, Yemenite minyan, but I was really I really hated to be there on a Monday and a Thursday because with the extra prayers that really went on and on.
The Yemenite are not Haredim.
Well, Eidot HaMizrach, okay, I understand, but
I think it's Pasach HaBracho, it says that since the destruction of the temple, the gates of prayer are closed, the gates of tears remain open.
Right. Well, obviously it doesn't mean it to the same degree that it says it. What it basically means is, when a gate is closed, you have to knock harder for it to be opened. All it means is that indeed, there is not having the korbanot which facilitated the acceptance of prayer. There is more of an effort that we need to put into tefillah. That's very, very true. So a gate could be closed. It doesn't mean it's locked. And of course, tears is really that which augments prayer. Right? Because what are tears? Tears are the heartfelt feelings and emotions. So essentially it's making the point that prayer that's an automatic pilot just doesn't work as much as it might have worked with the korbanot. But the prayer coming from the dima'ot, does. Also, I should say too that it's brought down that the gate of music is slightly lower than the gate of tears. So tears is still the strongest type of prayer, but the emotions that are aroused with Medina, with music, are also considered to be very, very powerful ways of bringing a person to a spiritual connection with God.
I heard someone make an observation that imagine what it's like with God.
all these years all day, problems.
Yes.
Nobody ever tells me anything good. Everybody's always telling you what's wrong.
Well, yeah, you're right. Although Rabbi Twersky, in one of Rabbi Twersky's books, Dr. Abraham Twersky writes about the first time he understood what real prayer was, communion, is he once went to the Kotel, to the Western Wall, and while he was davening, an old, was a Yemen, also a Yemenite person came, who was blind, and he was escorted by his grandchildren, as it were, and he starts talking to the wall, talking to God. He says, you know, God, I really had a rough day yesterday, but these good things happened. And he said, you know, I'm really so grateful that this happened and that. And then he catches himself and says, oh, I'm sorry, I told you that already. Okay, you know, and he really had it, and Rabbi Twersky is watching this, and he says, here, I've been davening all my life. And tefillah is called conversation. Sicha is one of the lashonot of tefillah. Conversation with God. And here, I really understood, he says, for the first time in my life, what it means to really have a conversation that is such a palpable reality to a person. And that's not a function of intellectualism, that's really a function of emotional connection, which is, you know, hard for us to get sometimes. But that is really the epitome of tefillah. Let me share with you another thought from Rav Tzadok. He's the one who said the thunder and the lightning thing. And he says a beautiful thought about tefillah, which also deals a little bit with the theodicy, the issue of the righteous suffering and the like. And he points out the fact that our three tefillot, which Rav Yehuda Levi says corresponds to the three meals that you need, although again, it bothers me a little bit, it's a little bit of a weak analogy, because in the time of Chazal they only ate twice a day, they had a big meal, but okay, be it as it may, but the evening prayer is actually considered to be a little bit optional, so it's it actually fits. But he points out that we sometimes lose sight, particularly in modern culture, of the significance of the transitions between day and night. The concept that Shacharit is ideally supposed to be prayed right as the sun is coming up. And Arvit is supposed to be prayed, you know, right when it becomes dark, the transition of day and night. And Mincha is in the middle. And he points out the following anomaly. There's a statement, this is well known, that the prayer of Shacharit was enacted by Avraham. Patriarch Avraham enacted. Now this doesn't mean the words of the Shemone Esrei, that was later, but the idea of praying in the morning is Abraham's prayer. The afternoon, the Mincha, is the prayer of Yitzchak, and the Ma'ariv is the prayer of Yaakov, right? This is the idea that each of the Avots is connected to a particular tefillah. Now here, Rav Tzadok raises a very intriguing halachic problem, and that is, Shacharit is an absolutely mandatory prayer within halacha. Mincha is a mandatory prayer, but the prayer of Arvit, we rule, is technically an optional prayer, although because of long-standing custom it is treated as mandatory, but originally Arvit is an optional prayer. This is called Rishut. If you want to do it, do it. You don't have to do it. I don't mean the Shema of the evening, I mean the Amidah of the evening. So Rav Tzadok says this is very incongruous. Why should the prayer of Avraham be mandatory and the prayer of Yitzchak be mandatory, but the prayer of Yaakov be specifically the one that might be treated as halachically optional, particularly since in rabbinic tradition Yaakov is regarded on some level as the greatest of the patriarchs, because Avraham had good son, bad son, and Yitzchak had good son, bad son, and although Yaakov also had trouble from his sons, but nevertheless all of Yaakov's children, like Yaakov is the progenitor, all of whose children enter the Jewish people, although not without tensions. So the question is, why should it be Yaakov's prayer that is, as it were, inferior to the prayer of Avraham and Yitzchak? So Rav Tzadok offers the following explanation. Each prayer, although it might be the identical words, calls to mind a different emotional mood and spirit depending on the time of day. The dominant motif of the morning prayer, the feelings that should accompany a person, is one of renewal, one of gratitude, one of appreciation for the gifts that God has given them in their lives. Right? Most people, in the morning, although, you know, people might have difficulty getting up, but usually the morning is a time in which, you know, a person feels fresh, a person feels renewed, a person feels a little bit better to take on the challenges of the day. It's even reflected in the halakha that when you visit the sick, So it says the following: you visit a sick person, because Kolim, the Gemara says, you shouldn't visit them the first 3 hours of the day, because they're going to look so chipper, you may not pray for them. You'll figure everything's okay, and you're supposed to pray for the sick. And don't visit them the last 3 hours, before evening, because they'll look so wan and so pale and so tired, you'll give up hope and won't pray for them. You figure, oh, he's a goner. So ideally, you visit in the middle of the day when you're not so good and not so bad, and therefore, you know, you'll pray for them. The Talmud says this. But be it as it may, the prayer of Shachrit, the mood of Shachrit, is one of joy, appreciation, gratitude, and hope. This is appropriate to Avraham's life, because at least towards the end of his life, Avraham lived a life of wonderful blessings. In other words, at the end of his life, and he had Yitzchak, Yitzchak was spared, even Yishmael came back and did Shiva. Right? Even the, in other words, there really was a reconciliation in Avraham's life to a very unusual degree. On one hand, he had to banish Hagar and Yishmael, but Sarah eventually died at 127, so it was, you know, a good old age, although obviously it was Aveilut. They had their child Yitzchak at the age of, he was 100 years old, Sarah was 90. And even Yishmael came back, and not only that, but according to rabbinic tradition, the keturah that he married is none other than Hagar. So even that relationship came to fruition. He was respected, even by the non-Jewish indigenous populations, although they stiffed him when it came to buying the burial plot. That's true, he paid a lot of money. But nevertheless, they went through, you know, Nesi Elohim, you are a prince of God. Great man, he is greatly admired in the world. He left this, and even Esav, his grandson, it said, did not become openly defiant and evil until after Avraham died. God promised Avraham, you will not see any of your descendants in a bad way. So Avraham lived a life of relative closure, in which the dominant idea would be gratitude, appreciation, joy. That's Shachrit. Yitzchak's life is already a bit different. Yitzchak was still wealthy, powerful, influential within the Canaanite society. But in Yitzchak's life, there's already a sense of being an alien, being a stranger. In fact, according to rabbinic tradition, the 400 years of alienage that were prophesied to Abraham didn't begin in Egypt, because we were only in Egypt 210 years. It began from the birth of Yitzchak in the land of Israel. That he's already an alien. It wasn't, in other words, he has a sense, I'm in a land that's not mine. The analogy that always comes to mind is how a Jew might have felt in Germany in, let's say, 1932 or 1933, the very beginning, where, you know, you have your law practice, you're successful, you know, you've made it in German society, but you begin to get the feeling you're not quite welcome here. And that is symbolized with the notion of mincha. It's still daytime, but the shadows are getting longer and longer. Yitzchak's prayer of mincha is the prayer that emanates from the attitude, God, I still have my blessings, but I'm afraid they're going away from me. Let me hold on to what I have. You see, each Av enacts a prayer at a time of day that corresponds to the emotional trauma or the emotional feelings that they have in their lives as a dominant chord. Yitzchak was a mincha person. It's still daylight, but the sun is going down. Which is why, by the way, once again, mincha ideally, although you could daven mincha anytime after the middle of the day, but ideally mincha should be davened shortly before the sunset. There should be that sense of transition from the brightness of day into the darkness of night, the lengthening shadow. Now we now come to my, again, and the picture that comes to mind, I mentioned in Germany in 1933. Another picture might be the New York Stock Exchange. At they close at 4 p.m.? Is it? Yeah, 4, yeah. Where, you know, if you ever see a picture, how this frenetic activity to try to get in those sales before the gong rings, because then it's not possible. And of course, in agricultural society, every single sunset was kind of a mini panic, because pre-electric lights, once the sun went down, you couldn't do anything. So there always is kind of this panic, this fear, will I get it in time? Okay? And that might, so that's mincha. We now come to Arvit, to Ma'ariv. When according to the rabbinic interpretation of this, when did Yaakov enact the prayer of Arvit? So we are told that when he ran away from Esav, Esav threatened to kill him after he took the blessings. And Yaakov, according to tradition, is 63 years old. He's not a youngster. Again, there are calculations. He's penniless. He's without a wife. He doesn't have children. He's running away from a brother who wants to kill him. He's leaving the holiness of Israel. He's leaving his father's home, and he thinks he'll never see his father again, although indeed, Yitzchak survived many years. Yitzchak was still alive when Yosef is sold, if you figure out the years, but certainly the impression you get is that Yaakov thinks he's never going to see his father or mother again. And where is he going? He's not going to a spiritually uplifting environment. He's going to the house of Lavan, a cheater, a deceiver. And in Midrashim, we find that Yaakov had a tremendous fear that Lavan would destroy him morally. Esav, right? So he's running away from the Esav who will chop his head off into the Lavan who may destroy his soul. And Yaakov, penniless, friendless, familyless, leaving the land of Israel, leaving his father, going to a spiritually jeopardizing environment, is not the Avram who can pray for the light and the joy of life. And he's not even the Yitzchak who still has things but feels them slipping away. Yaakov has hit bottom. Yaakov is in total darkness. Arvit is the prayer and the cry of the soul that comes from a person who has lost everything but his faith in Hashem. Arvit is the prayer of faith. Arvit is the commitment to connect to God even when everything is totally dark and totally bleak. Keep in mind that although Yaakov did have the vision of the divine ladder, that came in response to his prayer. The prayer came first. So in a sense, therefore, Shacharit is the prayer of gratitude and appreciation. Mincha is the prayer of panic. And Arvit is the prayer of faith. Faith that even when all is dark. So Rav Tzedek says very beautifully, you know why Arvit is optional? This is his question. This is the, he says the following. Because prayer based on gratitude, everybody can be expected to do. Even an animal appreciates the hand that feeds it. And mincha, when you have something, you of course turn to God to be able to hold it up. However, Arvit is a very sublime level of spiritual connection. That's the ability to sense the loving presence of God, even in the darkness. It is optional, not because it's less important, but because it represents a heightened and elevated level of faith that not everybody will always be able to experience. It's an aspirational level of prayer, as opposed to a mandatory level of prayer. So therefore, its optionality is a function of its uniqueness, not a function of its lesser significance. That's the idea of Marit. So you see, of course, now that we have electric lights, all of this is totally lost on us. I mean, you know, is my mood Marit any different than Mincha? You know, it's all the same. But the concept was that the externalities of the prayer were designed to evoke within the soul a different experiences. There are experiences of hope, there are experiences of panic, there are experiences of faith. And all of that is represented. And that is why we say that day and night are metaphors. Day is when one is living a blessed, charmed existence. And night is when one seems to be all alone and fearful and doesn't have any of those blessings. And that's why David HaMelech says in Tehillim, "Lahagid baboker chastecha, in the morning I declare your loving kindness, b'emunatcha balelot, and in the nights I declare my faith in you." Well, sleep is a form of death. There's no question. The body is physically alive, but on the other hand, biyadcha, right? Biyadcha afkid ruchi. What do we say? In your hand, I. Now that's again, if a child develops that idea that you know God is a loving, comforting presence, then one might not be afraid of all of these things.
One more question.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, in other words, what does the word mincha mean? That's a good question. Mincha literally means well, mincha, but it's great. Mincha also means a gift. In biblical Hebrew, mincha is a matana, and it comes from the fact that the afternoon offering was called a mincha for Hashem. Yeah, but that's a good question. That's right. It doesn't correspond to the thing. But again, this highlights the fact that in a mechanical society and a technological society, the power of nature is lost upon us, the grandeur of nature. We don't get inspired by the sunsets and by the sunrises, number one. We're not up when the sun rises. Well, maybe not. Actually, now we probably are. And, and we're not outside when the sun sets, you know. But all of these things are designed to inspire a person. That goes back to the Kuzmi's first point, that looking at the physical grandeur of the world can be a very important augment to one's spiritual nature. Again, sometimes in the yeshiva world even, there's a little bit of a disparagement of that, which does create, I think, a certain narrowness of focus. Okay, then he goes on. What time do you have? Okay, just another 5 minutes, then we'll break. This one meant the final point. And after he goes into prayer, he then talks about the need for the Shabbat and the Yamim Tovim. And here it's very interesting that he says almost verbatim a statement that is everyone attributes to Achad Ha'am. Remember, Achad Ha'am is the famous Jewish romantic, how do you describe him? Romantic secular Zionist philosopher who says, although he probably did not keep Shabbat in its full extent, but he said, more than the Jews have kept the Shabbat has kept the Jews. Famous Achad Ha'am. I'm not sure if he plagiarized this from the Kuzari. The Kuzari didn't say the first step, but the Kuzari talked about how the Shabbat, just from a sociological perspective, has kept the Jewish people even physically alive for hundreds and hundreds of years, for thousands of years. Because he said that no matter how demeaning and degrading the environment was outside, when people would physically oppress you and enslave you and persecute you, we're not talking about the concentration camp, we're just talking about the ordinary perils of Galut life. When it came Shabbat, the most humble Jew, the most persecuted Jew, became like a king and a queen in their home, in which there was a concept that a human being is more than a beast of burden. A human being is a godly person who can, to some degree, distance themselves from all that goes around them. And he talked about the fact that this gave the Jew, Rabbi Yehuda Levi writes, tremendous psychological strength. This is very interesting. This is not even a spiritual explanation of Shabbat, although it emanates from the spirituality of Shabbat. But the concept of just knowing that the world does not own you, that you're not a beast of burden, that you have that freedom to separate and disengage. In fact, it's very interesting, Rev. Joseph Soloveitchik, they came out, this is very, Rabbi Aaron Rakefeth came out with a two-volume biography of Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. Very interesting. A lot of it is excerpts from tapes that, from lectures that Rabbi Soloveitchik had on tape. So Rabbi Soloveitchik describes some scenes from his childhood that in his little village where his father was a rabbi in Poland, so a lot of the Jews made their living as porters. They would meet carriages and trains, and they would carry these huge, huge valises and trunks and suitcases on their shoulders. They would carry huge, massive amounts. Actually, I saw this in Israel as well, because people would just carry these huge amounts. And there were people who were so bent over with this, they would be bent over almost, their head would almost be touching the ground, and they'd carry hundreds of pounds on their back. And they would work, 12 hours a day doing this. And although Rabbi Soloveitchik was a misnaget, he was not from a Hasidic family, but he used to occasionally enjoy attending Hasidic services, because it was a different, it's more singing and a different type of taste. And they're going into, and they end Shabbat very late. They continue singing for the third meal into the night. So Rabbi Soloveitchik asks the person next to him, when are they going to daven Maariv? It's like he doesn't really fit the culture. Nobody asks when are you going to daven Maariv. They just keep on going. So the person says to him, what's the matter? You're in a rush to end this? What's the rush? And then he said to Rabbi Soloveitchik, do you recognize me? And Rabbi Soloveitchik said, you look familiar, I don't really recognize you. He says, I'm that person who's carrying the suitcases. Nur Soloveitchik said he was a different person. There was a regalness, there was a dignity. He says, and this is what Avida Levi talks about, the transformative effect of Shabbat. And it's something for us to think about, because the truth of the matter is that although in our galut, so to speak, the galut that we are fortunate to have in our Western countries, we are not slaves in the sense of the Jews who were slaves in Egypt. We are not persecuted in the sense of the Jews in the ghettos. We have so many freedoms, but we are enslaved, of course, in our own ways. We're enslaved to the telephone, we're enslaved to the job schedules, we're enslaved to work weeks that for many people might be, you know, maybe as long as the Jews in Egypt, I'm not sure how many hours the Jews did work in Egypt, and the like. And Shabbat is the time in which we get to savor what it means really to be free. Although I always say that for rabbis that's not necessary, so that's like to work in Shabbat. But the idea is, and therefore, and Avida Levi's point again is a very, very beautiful point. Again, as we're going through this, you see, of course, that the Kuzari, although the Kuzari does have his share of some speculative philosophy, the Kuzari is much more of a book describing what Judaism is for Jews. Meaning, he's not so interested as he, you know, he goes through the motions of proving this and that, but his passion is not to prove anything. His passion is just to explain what Judaism is. So it really is a very, what you would call a devotional work, perhaps even more than it is a philosophical work. Okay, so again, just to repeat, next week we do not have a class, and following that, I'll have to reserve the room. Is the room available on Thursday?
Yeah, the room
Thursdays?
Might be reserved, but just,
okay. Following that, every Wednesday session will have to be on a Thursday, so it'll be one day off. Now that also means though, that some of the canceled dates...
You could actually have... You don't have to cancel if you don't want. You could go ahead and finish it earlier.
Okay, so the next week we'll keep the cancellation because that's already planned. But after that, we'll discuss it. In other words, give thought to whether we need to have any other cancellations. We could finish the course earlier by doing it on Thursday.
Have more classes.
Right. Or have more classes.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
That's it.
And if it's any inconvenience to anybody, we apologize.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I guess I'm not available Wednesday. So the next class will be Thursday, January 20th. Yeah, January 20th in this room.
January 20th
is the next
room,
next
right.
class.
9:30. The other announcement is that those people who are registered for the graduate class and adult learners can pick up their material for the first two sessions from Kitty, like Alex and
Exactly. You take
questions?
I gave out the program which will be announced in the Jewish
Oh, okay. I didn't get it from my... I do look, it looks very good. I didn't get a chance to. I want to read it again.
That must be
what
just
a
reference.
Why? What did you see? Doesn't have to be like the official paper. I just read it once,
but it was very good. My grandson
was going to the
funeral.
That's what
I'm
doing. More spiritually
appropriate.
It's just interesting points. It's the afternoon rest, you mean? The siesta after lunch.
I need to know what you're going to talk about. Just sort of a general topic.
Let me ask you a question. I could talk about different topics, but is there going to be an overlap, let's say, with the BJE conference? A lot of people going to be the same.
What BJE?
The one that we had.
No, the one.
If I were to talk about the same type of thing for at least one of the talks.
No problem.
Because you're
going to have some principles from it, but it's a national conference, so you will have, you know.
But I'm not going to have like 300 people who are.
No, absolutely not. No, especially on Tuesday, because Tuesday's not the day the teachers are there even.
Okay.
So it's fine.
Okay. So one talk might be the goals of Jewish education.
Okay, let me get the intent on first.